Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
No.
Why are you saying no? I didn't even ask you a question.
That's just how I answer my phone now.
I was just saying hi. Fuck, shit's weird. Alright, bye.
I'm Dan Nalen, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and it is one of the oldest independent publications in the entire United States. Distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action, sports, and subculture, it is available every place cool. In this episode, we talk to the Salt City Slam poetry people. We talk to a man who's running across the country, quite literally, one marathon at a time. And we talk to Casey Jarman, the man who puts together the annual Twilight Concert Series in Salt Lake City. Salt City Slam is a group of slam poetry competitions and performances that goes on throughout the year in Salt Lake City. They include both pre-written poetry and open mic freeform styles, and until recently they had their monthly events at the Moe's Bar and Grill. But they moved over to Weller Bookworks, the sweet new bookstore that's located inside Trolley Square, and it's now hosted on the last Monday of every month. Slug writer Brinley Froelich sat down with SCS Jesse Parent to talk about the group, the new performances, and their brand new location.
How long has Salt City Slam like been around for, and how did you guys all meet up and get together?
There's an interesting oral history going on. I'm trying to compile that into a more official history. But I know in the movie Slam Nation, which was a documentary about the 1996 National Poetry Slam, they say Salt Lake City. But that predates a lot of our current organizers. So Melissa Bond started up Salt City Slam years and years ago, and then it passed on to her from her to Jaguar Duffy, and then to Shea Svenneker, who had the slam going on at Cup of Joe over near the Gateway Mall, and that's where I first got there. Right a couple years before that, in the 2005 timeframe, there was a really big movement of just collaborative art and wonderful sharing of poetry and kind of people pushing each other. And so that's where, in fact, if you go to our slams, you'll hear people shout push, because we're trying to push our energy into the poet. And then in 2007, that's where I discovered it. And I sort of came in at the end of an era where those folks were starting to move on. And we were beginning to form a new idea of what the slam movement was going to be versus this more lyrical, really poetic stylings that worked great on paper, but sometimes didn't really find their way out into the ether when you were performing it. And so from having a theater background, I brought more of a theater aspect to it and was really more interested in narrative style. And we started to grow more narrative from that point on.
Can you kind of explain what slam involves and like how it differs from other types of poetry readings?
Sure. I always try to tell people slam is more of an aesthetic than a form. When you go to a poetry reading, a lot of times folks are sharing the work, they're looking for critique, or they're just putting it out into the world. And really, it's a bit of a shame because it becomes a spit your shit and split kind of thing, mm-hmm. where you're saying, hey, look, I'm here to say my stuff and then I'm going to leave. And mm-hmm. And versus slam is this immediate feedback from the audience. And it was built for that. Mark Smith in the mid-80s, when he first came up with the idea of slam in Chicago, he wanted to take it out of the hands of the academics, where they were just, it was sort of this verbal masturbation on paper in his mind. And I'm not going to say that it was or was not, but for him it was, what is the audience going to get out of this? And so he put a certain constraints around it, saying, hey, let's make this a competition. We'll pick five members of the audience, and we won't get five professional poets, we'll get five members of the audience. And what do you have? You have five people who are keenly interested in what you have to say. And then you make the audience a factor of it. You say, the audience, you're supposed to sway the judges. So it's the audience's job to listen and judge as to whether or not the judges are agreeing or disagreeing with them on the quality of a poem. Mm-hmm. Again, the idea is to make this accessible so that you have a time limit and it's 3 minutes, or else you get points deducted, so that you're not just droning on and on like I am right now. And then you get an immediate score and say, hey, look, this either people thought this sucked or people thought this was great. Let's figure out what was great about it, what sucked about it, and make some changes or keep it.
Cool. So in a competition, like, are there different categories, or what are, like, how does it work exactly in a competition setting?
So in a competition setting, there really aren't different categories. It's, you have 3 minutes to say something, mm-hmm. figure out what the audience wants to hear and what you want to say. And, you know, it makes it sound like that means that you have to write for the audience. It's not necessarily true, but you have to connect to the audience. You have mm-hmm. to, you can't be so introspective that you're no one can relate to you. But if you say a real truth, someone in the audience ought to be able to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. So the idea is you've got a time limit, go do your thing, and then at the end of that time limit, judges will score you, and then we'll take the high score and the low score, and in the middle there's some real score between 0 and 30. Other than time, there really, sometimes there will be a themed slam, but those are rare. And we actually just did one right before Arts Fest that was themed on food. So it was, it was cool. There was this organization that is promoting more urban farming and more ideas of, like, how do we self-sustain, you know, like backyard mm-hmm. chickens, which are my thing. I do backyard chickens. Awesome. I think backyard mm-hmm. chickens are awesome. I didn't think they were going to be awesome, but until I started getting the eggs. And I'm like, oh, wow, free protein. That's awesome. I can work out more.
Omelets.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, let's quiche every day. I feel less guilty when I'll do, like, egg whites mm-hmm. For, like, omelets or for shakes, and I feel less guilty about throwing out the yolk when I know that I didn't, like, just, I don't know why, that's just my thing. Anyway, so sometimes there's a theme,
okay.
But there, it usually is more of what is landing today and what's the audience into, and you have to remember, it's just slam.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean that you're a bad artist or a good artist necessarily, it just means that that was the aesthetic of the day.
Do you just improv on the spot, or do you ever, like, plan things ahead of time and then kind of recite that?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I got into slam because of improv. I tour nationally as an improv comedian with a group called Joker and Jester. And so I do Jester, and there's another guy who does Joker, who is actually a really great slam poet now. And so we wanted to create a form that was poetry related, so we started doing improvised poems and touring, forming another group called The Hook, and that went to a certain point, and I said, I don't know what to do, I think I'll just start going to regular poetry slams. And originally my idea was, like, I would just improvise all the poems, and I was scared to death of writing. As it started to go on, I realized that there's, you know, there's real craft to this. It's not just folks getting up and making the crowd go roar. It's real, genuine art. And so it forced me to really think about it and take the time to write down my words and really pour over it. And I don't take the performance aspect out of it. My motto is performance is punctuation. You have to be able to really use performance to ramp up what the words say, but the words are important. Mm-hmm. So most of what's going on is written and highly polished.
How long are the competitions usually?
They range from 3 to 5 days. The national tournament will start, will go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. The individual tournaments will usually be three days. So that's, you know, Thursday and Friday for prelims, Saturday for finals, with maybe having Wednesday as a last chance to get in slam, where they have, like, one slot and they're saying, okay, who wants it? Come to a slam. And those are usually a lot of fun too.
And if somebody wanted to get into slam poetry, how would they kind of get involved here in Salt Lake? And then maybe go on to, like, the National Poetry Slam competition.
You know, we have a very, very welcoming community. And that's actually what really struck me about getting into slam was I was nervous. I was like, oh, new people, they'll hate me. And they, you know, folks are very, very inviting here. What I usually tell people to do is our Facebook group, Salt City Indie Arts. There's a lot of information there. Greenhouse Effect Open also has a lot of information. The Greenhouse Effect open mic is every Sunday at 7:30 p.m. at Greenhouse Effect Coffee on the corner of 3300 South and 9th East, and that's a great place to go and experience music, open mic, poetry, open mic comedy, and that's a very welcoming community. For slam, there are three slams, actually four, going on in the immediate area. There is the first, which is Salt City Slam. That's the oldest one that is every last Monday of the month, and we're now in Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square Mall So that starts at 8 p.m. on the last Mondays. And then Riverton also has a slam out at The Coffee Shop. It's actually called The Coffee Shop, which is super, it's hard to tell, like, hey, just go to The Coffee Shop. Where? Which one? The Coffee Shop. It's out 123rd South in Bangor, and they are the second Thursday of the month. And then in Ogden, Grounds for Coffee is the third Tuesday. And then Provo, there's also a scene out there, and I have a little bit less information about that. But again, if folks go to Salt City Indie Arts, they can get in contact with us there, or they can just contact me.
So do you write poetry, or do you only perform it, and do you have, like, a preference over writing versus performing?
So do I write just for the page or always for the stage? I would say that about 20% of the work that I write, I perform. And a lot of it is the process, it's the craft, it's, I have a friend, Alvin Lau, who really pushes me on craft, and so we're actually in an active conversation about different theories of craft, of just written poetry, because the idea is that the word is what you build around, the performance you build from the word, and every now and again you have high concept stuff, and I like to do concept performances. I have a poem about a swastika where I am a swastika. Also a poem called Sock Puppet where I have a sock puppet. But for the most part, I'm writing with a goal to get something performed, but part of that goal is to write poetry, get feedback, and improve your writing. And a great exercise for our poetry scene is in April, it's National Poetry Month, and that's usually we have NaPoWriMo, which is National Poetry Writing Month. You do 30 poems in 30 days, and that's when everybody's tagging each other in notes on Facebook and saying, why haven't you read my poem? It actually is a great way to just sit down and say, I'm going to write a poem every day. And it very much is like working out. You need to write, and you need to read in order to write. You can't just write in a vacuum and say, I don't want to ruin my voice. You have to read other people. You have to read the classics. You have to read your contemporaries. Folks are pushing all the time, and there are always great ideas that are found just by going back to the basics.
Where do you hope to see the Salt City Slam group going?
You know, what's been amazing about the last 4 or 5 years of growth in our community has been, when I first slammed at the National Poetry Slam in 2007, we came second to last. Last 2 years, we've made semifinals. I'd love to see us get to a final stage. And we had this great concept of just doing all biblical pieces that progressed into, that built one on the other, but were completely separate, that I would have loved to have had been on final stage. So I guess final stage would be a great tangible goal, but really what I want is, I just want to see growth. I want to see more people interested in influencing each other and being kind to each other and helping to grow the community. We've already expanded that to having now College Slam at the University of Utah and at Westminster. And I'd love to see us do Brave New Voices, which is more in the high school realm of age, or even Louder Than a Bomb, which is an inter-high school competition. It would just be amazing to me to see people continue to be kind to each other, continue to welcome new voices and be influenced by those new voices, and to recognize where they have chances to mentor new poets when they're asking for help rather than saying, well, you know, you're on your own, kid, bye. That's really what I'm hoping for, is that we recognize that we are a scene and not just individual artists that are selfish. We recognize the power we have to influence each other as well as an audience.
Do you think there's kind of like a Salt Lake-centric style or certain themes that are touched on a lot by slam poets in this area?
Yeah, I think everybody goes through like their periods, right? The religious poet that I was talking about, we went through this big thing on the scene where everybody was writing religious poems. Mm-hmm. And we're in a little bit of a political movement right now. But I think the Salt Lake scene is very narrative. The math of it is, you can clearly see it in poets like Gray, who's an amazing poet, Joker, who's my improv partner, myself. I'm very mathy, so I like patterns. There's also the performance aspect of it, of making sure that you are moving with purpose. And I think that's what we try to also communicate to our, as we grow each other, is that, why are you bouncing around your poet voice? Why are you speaking like this? I believe that the style of Salt Lake has become a narrative literary style that is also has lyrical foundations. The most interesting comment we ever got was when we competed in Albuquerque and lost badly a few years ago, and someone comes out and goes, oh, look at Salt Lake City trying to win poetry slams with poetry. And you know that we want there to be some integrity in the art. and we don't want to just cater. So you don't see a lot of pandering poems coming out of Salt Lake. Not to say that there aren't any, but we try to enforce each other. We try to push each other to push narrative and push big turns and big surprises and messages and making things clear and accessible.
When is the competition and where?
The competition for the National Poetry Slam is going to be August 12th through the 18th in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Actually, Cambridge, Boston, Somerville, so which is my home area. So cool. I get to see my family, and I'm really excited about that. And I get to probably show off my accent. So I hide my accent a little bit more when I'm out in the Midwest. It just makes it easier to understand me when my R's aren't all over the place.
Salt City Slam will happen this coming Monday, July 29th at Weller Bookworks starting at 7 p.m. For more information on the group, visit them online at feedthemuse.net/Salt City Slam. Know-It-All is a five-piece punk rock band from right here in Salt Lake City. The group consists of Brad Baxter, Adam Vasquez, Mike Hunter, Jason Mondragon, and Matt Moit, and they released their debut album at the end of June called I Wanna Be Your Superhero. We're going to play a song called Coffee and Cigarettes off of that debut. Know-It-All currently has no known social media outlets, but you can download the album right at knowitall.bandcamp.com. This fellow Steve Cannon is quite the amazing story. He's an American marathon runner, originally from Iowa, and since 1994, he's been running races all over the country, participating in more than 100 marathons, all told. He's completed a 24-hour run around Grays Lake, he became the second person ever to run all the way across Iowa, and this past summer he became the first person ever to run all the way around Lake Michigan. He's organized a thing called the Million Dollar Marathon, where he runs from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Pacific, with cancer survivors joining him along the way, working with the Above and Beyond Cancer Foundation to raise a little money. Slug senior writer Mariah Mellis spoke with Cannon on the phone about his running and his charitable efforts.
So Steve, tell me a little bit about what got you running and what inspired you to run 40 marathons in 40 days.
Well, it's a bit of a process. I always joke whenever I talk to people, be careful about running because it can hook you and you can end up doing things years down the road that you would have never imagined, and that was the case for me. I didn't run a single race until I was late in my 20s, and I was in Colorado Springs and didn't really know anybody. I'd moved out there, and so I signed up to do a 5K just in hopes I could meet some of those fit runner girls out in Colorado. So that's how it all started, and somehow or another that morphed into running across the state of Iowa to raise money for the Livestrong organization, and then just through the people I met and that experience, I wanted to continue down that path. And, you know, you can't hardly raise any money by doing something smaller. You have to kind of go larger, or nobody really pays attention. So Lake Michigan became the next project, and that was also done to raise money for the Livestrong Foundation. And now I'm fortunate enough to be working for a group called Above and Beyond Cancer, who is presenting this million-dollar marathon.
Yeah, so we should say you will be running, now that you've done the 40 marathons in 40 days, you've taken that from kind of a personal experience and your own quest to bringing that out to the people of the United States, and you're going to run, well, not you personally, with a team, lots of helpers, from Washington State to Washington, D.C. Did I have that right?
We'll go through Washington, D.C., and just 2 days later, we officially finish in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
But, oh, Delaware.
You're real close. We're going to go right through there, and that's going to be a big stopping point for us.
That's awesome. So, you know, I think of Forrest Gump and how Forrest just starts running and he just keeps running, and then finally he stops and goes, like, wait a second, I've been running forever. But he's always got these people following around. So I kind of in my head envision that Steve starts running and all these people are joining in. So tell me a little bit about the logistics of this and how people are going to run so that people will know what to be looking for.
Well, one of the cool things is I'm probably answering this question not for people only that are listening, but also for you, because if anybody listening doesn't know, Mariah is actually one of the runners in this event, and so that's super cool. But we will start off, and I think there's times when it'll probably look a little bit like Forrest Gump going down the road, because we have so many people that are involved in the event. There's four marathons run a day, but those four people running those marathons all will have, you know, a couple people, in some cases as many as 50, that are joining them for a mile or 2 miles or whatever the case may be. So, and many of them are cancer survivors. The thrust of the run is to educate people on the value of exercise and diet in the fight against cancer. The American Cancer Society released this year that more people will die of lack of activity and poor diet for the first time ever versus tobacco use, which is a pretty staggering thing to think about. But the exciting part of that is that, you know, that really speaks to prevention. And so if we can get that message out there, then get people moving and inspired by people like you, then maybe we prevent these cancers from happening in the first place, and certainly help in the lack of reoccurrences. So it's a simple message, but one that has a lot of meaning.
Well, and yes, as far as full disclosure, I am going to be running in this race. I'll say I was a smoker for 10 years and only picked up running about 3 years ago, and it has, just like Steve said, taken me down some crazy roads and paths and got me doing things like running, a marathon in the middle of nowhere. It's definitely led me to some interesting endeavors, and I say all of them positive. You know, some of them a little wacky, definitely challenging, but definitely positive experiences. So, Steve, what do you think is the key to linking, or why do we link running with fundraising? Do you know? Like, I realize so many people are running for a cause.
Well, certainly you have the inspiration from the people you meet and the people that are dealing with the disease, whether it be personally that they have cancer themselves or family or friends that are dealing with it. And so you certainly draw inspiration from that. The other thing I think with running is that it's universal. It's something that we all can relate to, we all can do. You know, most of us are never gonna, play basketball like Michael Jordan or, run like Usain Bolt or do anything like that. But the one thing that we all do have the ability to do, for the most part, is to step out our front door, lace up our shoes, and go for a walk or a jog around the block or a mile. And, it's a very personal endeavor because we can always, go a little further. There's always that ability to, to feel really good about yourself because you just went a mile when before you could only do a half mile, or you just completed your first marathon or half marathon or 10K, when you didn't see that as being possible. And so that runner's high is really out there for everybody. And I think regardless of the distance, anybody that's gone out for a run or a walk, they felt that. So it's something that everybody can relate to. And I think that's why the fundraising resonates as well, is that people ran at some point or the marathon is a bucket list for them. Couple that with the fact that you have these amazing stories, these amazing people that are overcoming so much and doing the marathon. It's a pretty compelling story.
Definitely. Well, and I noticed too, it's mile by mile, dollar by dollar. So you've got, all these people working together to get you and the race across the United States, but also each runner is raising money to go towards this $1 million. And how are you going on that goal? And if people are interested in joining up or being a part of it, is there something for next year that they're inspired to do and can tell their friends and family about, or something for Beyond Cancer that we can leave people with that they can take some action and be a part of this?
Absolutely. The website is coasttocoastforcancer.org, and that's all spelled out. And anywhere on there, you can read about the route, the individual stories. There's a page that is dedicated just to the team that your picture is on, as well as 100 or more other people. And any one of those boxes you click on, you're going to be inspired. We'll have an online tracking system during the event. So, whether it's the day before, a week before, or whatever the case, anybody can come out and join us for their own reasons. Cancer is a horrible disease, and unfortunately, every single person on the planet has some kind of connection to it. So we all have a reason to be out there. And what's cool is we have individuals that are running a marathon. We have groups running marathons. So just there in Salt Lake City, for example, we're going to have a group of about 15 people that are joining together to knock out 75 miles. So, each person going to run, anywhere from 3 to 10 miles and to spend the whole day together. So, we invite everybody to come out and help spread the word and maybe, do something in memory of or for somebody that they know.
For more information on the run and to donate to the cause, check out coasttocoastforcancer.org. This is your weekly daily calendar for the week starting July 23rd and running through July 29th. As always, you'll want to go to slugmag.com and check out the listings every damn day of the week. There is good stuff being added all the time. Plenty of options for your entertainment dollar right here in Salt Lake and beyond. And of course, you can add your own events for free and for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year, add some quality links and content to your very own listings. When I peruse this week, there is a ton of good stuff starting on Tuesday, July 23rd. Adam Ant of the legendary Adam and the Ants, and of course a stellar solo career after. He's headlining at the Complex. I will be in attendance. This is sort of a fulfillment of a lifelong dream to see one of the most fashionable early 80s rock stars there ever was. Should be a really fun show. Bad Rabbits, Orbit Group, Beachmen, and Air Dubai are all joining forces for what should be a really cool show that same night at Bar Deluxe, Tuesday the 23rd. If you want a little bit of a, you know, experimental rock, a little jazz to it, that's a good show for you. Same night, you know, Kenny Loggins cannot come to Utah without getting a mention. The man behind Footloose and myriad other soundtrack hits. He's headlining up at Red Butte Gardens on that night. So, you know, maybe go hang around outside, bring your boots, do a little dancing. And that same night, Music at Main at the Main Library features the Gypsy Rockers of Wanagani along with Rev Mayhem. Wednesday, July 24th, Pie and Beer Day to those of us here in Utah. Slash brings his band to Park City Live. I saw Slash a couple years ago at the Depot. I was highly skeptical of seeing Slash with a singer that wasn't Axl Rose. It actually was a lot more fun than I anticipated. You know, you get all of your Guns N' Roses hits that you want to hear. You get the fucking top hat that he wears. What more do you want out of a Slash show? Should be a good time. His band is actually pretty solid. Thursday, the 25th, one of the epic shows of summer, Flaming Lips, headlining at the Twilight Concert Series down at Pioneer Park. Great opening band, thanks to CSS bringing the dance rock with them. That is going to be an amazing show. Same night up at Red Butte Gardens, pretty much the coolest country guy there is, Dwight Yoakam, headlining a show. He's never played Red Butte. Should be a lot of fun. If you like your rootsy rock, he's a man to go to. Friday, July 26th, speaking of rootsy rock, Wayne the Train Hancock, he returns to the garage. He's a regular visitor there these days. He is an amazing guitar player, rock solid songwriter, always a good time. Same night over at Urban Lounge, a great night of local music thanks to Spirit Master, Koala Temple, and Holy Water Buffalo bringing the rock to the urban. Saturday, July 27th, Pink Lightning, back at the garage. We've featured them on this show in recent episodes. They have a new CD out. Should be a good time. Same night over at Urban Lounge, Red Benny's in one of their final shows in Salt Lake, along with Pentagram Crackers and Night Sweats. And then on Sunday, July 28th, more fine local blues rock with Clarksdale Ghosts out at the garage. Great stuff at the garage all weekend. That is your weekly daily calendar. As always, hit up slugmag.com every day. See what's going on in and around town and get out of the house. The Heartless Breakers are a rock band based right here in Salt Lake City. The band is typically a three-piece consisting of Matt Mascarenhas, Brian Lee, and Chase Griffiths, and they play along with an array of other musicians who join them for live shows. They're releasing their debut EP called Perceptions on July 23rd. We're going to play a song off of that called Bitter Melodies.
So madly, scratching at the surface, bleeding through this concrete. I'll be free and hope to be as happy as I seem. Sun to shine through the ozone that is bending.
looking at the sky, finding distant stars carefully aligned. Inventiveness buried in our minds, destined to have our time.
We'll be alright
and overcome, you'll see.
Let's drink away our broken dreams, then I'll stop complaining. We'll be just fine.
Right out for better me.
Can drink away our broken dreams until we stop complaining.
For more information on Heartless Breakers or to purchase music and other goodies, visit them online at heartlessbreakers.com. The Twilight Concert Series has grown from a few people on a hillside next to the Salt Lake Arts Center into a massive concert at Pioneer Park every Thursday over 6, 8, 9, 10 weeks in the summertime. It has grown exponentially over the years. It started way back in 1987. It's bounced around a little bit before settling on Pioneer Park. And it's also gone from featuring mostly local stuff to a really eclectic array of high-profile acts and national talent. Slug writer Gregory Garalot sat down with the series director and pretty much the man who put the whole thing together, Casey Jarman, to talk about the Twilight Concert Series history and this year's lineup.
First off, what was the original idea that started the Twilight Concert Series?
Well, I mean, for me, I started it this will be our 26th season, so it was 26 years ago. And I was running another concert series that's still around called the Brown Bag Concert Series. I still love that concert series. It was a concert series that I had taken over. I'd been a performer on that series, and I thought it needed to be run a little bit differently. And then they gave me that job to run it, and I ran that for a few years and had started this other festival called Living Traditions and was, you know, looking at the summer season. And the Arts Council, the directors of the Board of Directors of the Arts Council, and the Executive Director, they wanted to sort of expand the Brown Bag Concert Series, which is a noontime series, if anybody doesn't know about this. It's a noontime series, 12:15 to 1 p.m. Local artists mostly, some regional artists, a few national touring artists from time to time, mostly geared for local artists. And they wanted to expand that to a wintertime model that would have it, you know, like in malls and shopping centers and wherever it might be. I was not so interested in doing that. And I said, okay, we can do that. But if you'll give me a little bit of money, how about if we start, I'd like to start a series that is in the evenings, that's outside, that offers sort of whatever we can throw together in terms of interesting music and performing arts. And we'll make it free. I think it needs to be free so that the community can just kind of come down. I want to do this on a Thursday night because it's, well, I really selected Thursday nights because I had no budget for artists, and so I was trying to capture anybody coming from maybe Denver to San Francisco doing a gig. You know, maybe they've got a layover or something. Maybe I can catch them for a low fee on a Thursday night. You know, what do you think? And they said, well, okay, you know, here's $10,000, I think it was, the first year, and said, see what you can do. So I did 13 concerts outside, everything from modern dance to a very bizarre kind of Russian polka band that was traveling through. I'm not sure if we had a national touring artist that year or not, besides the polka, you know, a lot of local guys. And it was really fun, and it went well. You know, we had hundreds of people, and from that, I was able to get a few sponsorship dollars, a little more money here and there. And so that was the basic framework for it. And I think the concept was, in essence, to have a nice community event where people could, hopefully I could expose them to something they hadn't seen before or heard before. And so I've always tried to keep the music as progressive as I thought it was progressive. It's changed a lot over the years, but that was the initial sort of format. And I set up the sound. I had one assistant. We set up the stage, ran sound and lights, set up lights after the concert series, drove the band back to the hotel, came back, tore down the stage, and two-person operation back then.
Besides the artist fees, were there any other challenges that you faced back in the original days as opposed to now?
It's funny. I think that they're, you know, the same challenges apply. They're just different. You know, you go, oh, okay, how are we going to, we have staging issues, we have lighting issues, we have general production element issues, we have artists, writer issues, you know, the things are same, it's just the scale is so much greater. The challenges back then were really, I guess not as many. There really weren't as many. There weren't as many people that, if you know, it wasn't until really we started charging admission, it seemed like, which is only last year, that all of a sudden everybody woke up. Now, that's not the audiences, because the audience has been there for many, many years. And in fact, you know, when people look at Gallivan, or they go back to even the early days. So it started, if people don't know this, it started at the Salt Lake Arts Center. It was the Salt Lake Arts Center back then. It's now UMOCA. And they have a little sculpture court right in front of UMOCA. In between the sort of symphony and the Arts Center, there's a grassy area. And it's a little sunken amphitheater. And that's where we started it. It's on South Temple and West Temple. So in those days, it kind of grew slowly. And then eventually it started to get a name recognition. And we taped for rebroadcast some television shows for local PBS here. So it had a sort of a television sexiness to it at one time. And then people started to complain that it was getting too big. So now that we're about 2,500 people maybe. And that's when people said it's just getting too big, it's too popular. And I moved it to Gallivan. And Gallivan kind of chugged along, you know, it was great. We had a lot more room. We had a real stage, which was kind of nice. And it kind of went on there for a while. The challenges there were, again, it's always going to be budget, always making sure that you have, you know, the proper sort of infrastructure to produce the concerts, and that you have, you know, security and all that stuff. And it just kept growing. Every year it's just grown and grown and grown until eventually people started saying, wow, it's too crowded here at Gallivan. And so we moved to Pioneer Park, and I think it's worked out really well. But those challenges of budget, those challenges of, you know, staying, not anchoring, you know, I look at not anchoring yourself to any particular musical style or musical period or whatever it might be. And I've gone all over the place, obviously, from where we are this year with, from the Flaming Lips to when I did groups like Doc Watson and Earl Scruggs. You know, that's, I don't know if that's the full gamut, but it's, you know, maybe it's Kid Cudi to Doc Watson, I don't know, but... You have to respect the fact music is always going to evolve, and it's always going to hit really strong with that generation that grows up with that sort of music style. You know, it's this sort of 16 to 24, 25, where music is consuming you, and it's so wonderful. It still consumes me. I'm consumed all the time. It consumes everybody, but I think that there's a certain age period where it's really hits with you, and it's probably the most important thing in your life.
What kind of choosing or election process does the Art Council go through?
How do I select the artist? How do we book the series? Is that what you're asking, kind of?
Yeah, like, do you keep your thumbs on the pulse of pop music that year, or?
Well, you know, it's, I think that there's a wish list that I have, and I will say, you know, that I get good suggestions from a lot of people. My booking assistant for the last 4 years has been Vanessa Wardy, and she's been awesome. But we start out with a big wish list of artists, and they're ones that are new, and the ones that have been there for a while. Now, the ones that have been for a while, they sort of fade away if I haven't booked them. So we go back to that, we go to that list and say, okay, here's what I think, let's go after so-and-so, and on down the line. We send out inquiries about, are they available? Something new coming out? Are they working on anything? Can you give us a fee range? In general, you get, and anybody who's been in this business will know, they'll just say, send us an offer. It's kind of a crazy thing, you know.
That's the hardest.
They should, you know, there's a lot of other responses they get, and sometimes it's not that bad. So I go through this list of, like, the main course, planning a banquet, maybe you could look at it for a 7 or 9 course banquet. You say, okay, the main courses are going to be these artists. Let's start off with these. We'll get 20 artists and say, let's try to see if we can get, you know, some of these artists to confirm. And then you go and you talk to the agency, and you know these are artists that may have popped up during the summer. They may have been like a new band a few years ago. A new band would have been a Monsters of Men. Maybe that's a new band that sort of popped up, you know, or maybe it was 10 years ago when The National popped up, you know, or it was whoever it is. You know, someone has like all of a sudden crept into this thing, and then you go, I really want that band. And it's sort of we're not like a club that a club gets to be, you know, they're booking, they're a music club, so they've got music basically 7 days a week it could be. And it could be 350 days a year, I don't know. So if someone's touring a certain time period, they say, yeah, I'll take the Tuesday, I'll take the Sunday. I'm looking for nine shows, nine headline artists between July and August. It's got to be on a Thursday. So it's really kind of crazy that way. So people don't say yes. And it is interesting, you know, like all these bands this year, not all of them, I'll say. Let's say the National would be a case where I think my first offer for the National was in 2008. Offered every year. And just the process is you send an offer to an agency. We'll do them for this much money. We'll do all these other stuff. And they'll come back and say, yeah, they can do it. Or they'll come back and say, you know what, they're not touring this summer. They're going to be in Europe, whatever. So bands like the National, I've tried for a long time to get out here. I can't even tell you how long I've been trying to get the Flaming Lips out here. Same thing. Offers, I don't know, 10 plus years ago. So then they just finally, one year, they say, you know what, we can do it. And there you go. So it's not like you get to punch a button and say, this year we're going to do, let's see, we'll do the Flaming Lips, we'll do the National, we'll do Grizzly Bear. Grizzly Bear, same, I've had offers on them for years. So it's just that finally it comes around, and then you go through those things. And then the other bands that you offer on say, no, we're not going to tour. You hang on to them for a long time. They say, no, we can't do it after all those things that happen. Or they say yes, and then they say no. And you end up just sort of filling those spots in with what fills in. And as far as keeping the finger on the pulse, you know, yeah, I look at the other festivals. I see who's doing what. I try to read and listen to radio. Try to follow as much as I can. You sort of have a subliminal eyes and ears open all the time, and you don't even realize. And it's kind of stressful because when you hear something new, you, for me anyway, and probably a lot of people in the business, you don't necessarily just enjoy it when you first hear it. You say, wow, I wonder who represents them. I wonder if they're available. I wonder how much they're going to cost. So you immediately go into a business mode on these things. But it's an interesting, kind of crazy business. It's hard. The agencies are, some agents are nice and some are not so nice. Depending on how hip and in demand their artists are, they can treat you really nicely. They're going to say, well, yeah, well, whatever. We're going to do Coachella. We're going to do Sasquatch. We're going to do Outside Lands. And then we're going to forget about the Twilight Concert Series. So I don't know. You know, it's a great process, but it can beat you up sometimes, and it can be really rewarding.
It's definitely almost guaranteed to draw a certain, like, a bigger crowd this year, if I were to guess. I'm curious, earlier you mentioned one of the challenges you faced at Galavan was the size constraints. What would happen if you kind of pushed the girth of Pioneer Park to its limits? Yeah. What would be the next move after that?
Yeah.
Do you have, like, a plan?
Yeah, I do. You know, it was interesting when we... So in the first move from Galvin to Pioneer Park, that was kind of a big deal. It was big news, and everybody wanted to know what was going on. And I was nervous because Pioneer Park obviously doesn't have the best reputation. Well, I think it's kind of cool now, but it didn't have... I felt there was going to be some pushback from people who were not going to go to Pioneer Park because it was Pioneer Park. So I booked who I thought would be a really sort of slam dunk band so that people would almost... couldn't stay away, and that was Modest Mouse. The crossover, great generational thing. It's a great band. They've got great hits, great sort of catchy, what's the word I'm looking for, spots of their music. They reach a lot of different people, right? So I thought this will be great. You know, at least I'm going to get some people down to Pioneer Park for this. Well, I don't know if you were there or not, but it's turned into this sort of infamous concert where I remember being on stage and looking out. I was getting ready to bring Modest Mouse on. We'd gone through, I can't remember what the support was back then, but we'd gone through the support act. I'm getting ready to introduce Modest Mouse. Not introduce, but at least let the audience know they're coming up. I looked at all this massive crowd of people that I had never seen anything like it, certainly not from stage. Someone would move, you know, they'd be so tightly packed, someone would move, the whole sort of sea of people would move. It was really kind of terrifying that there were that many people. And then my director of security tapped me on the shoulder and said, we got to talk. And I said, well, I'm going to go. He said, well, you need to look. And he pointed behind me, and there were just six wide streams of people coming down, 3rd South, 4th South, 3rd West. And we were at capacity. And I just thought, oh, my goodness. And then someone said to me, so you went from crowded to insanely crowded in one concert. And we did. You know, it got crowded at Pioneer Park to where we had concerns about safety and all that stuff. And then the first show at Pioneer Park went nuts, just nuts. Now, since then, you know, I think that probably kept a lot of people away from coming back to the show. It's like, wow, that was insane. I'm not coming back there. But it's really not that way. The audience size has kind of calmed down. And they started coming back, and it got larger and larger. And so when we hit, so Modest Mouse, we stopped, we started closing the, not closing the gate, but at least stopping the immediate entry at 40,000 plus. There's probably maybe 50,000 that we sort of had bad counts that day. And there were many, many people. There's 20,000 plus that, more that wanted to come in. And
so you had to chase away 20,000 people.
We tried. Some didn't chase away so easily. Some climbed the fences and all that stuff, and that's another story. But then we got better at sort of slowing the flow, letting people in and out, sort of like a club situation. And then we hit 53,000, I know, with Lupe Fiasco 2 years ago. And at that time, I realized, look, this is 53,000 people at a concert. That's a lot of people. This can't go on. So I said, it's time now to do what I've talked about for many years, which is to start charging admission, so that hopefully that will stem the flow a little bit. It will make people be more invested. You know, they're gonna stay away because it was just free and they're just coming down to hang out. So those people probably stay away. They don't want to pay the $5. The people that do want to pay the $5 are going to be just a little bit more invested in what they're doing. And sometimes more invested, they're going to say, okay, I'm going to see 4 shows this year instead of 9. I'm going to go to see this band, and this band. When they get down there, that's what they're there for, is for the music. So that's a good thing. And it helped financially too, but not as much as people would think. In fact, a very small amount of financial increase in that. So last year was our first year of charging $5, and it was phenomenal. We went from averaging 33,000 plus per concert to 16,000, half the number of people. And the feel is better. It makes more sense. It feels like the people that are down there, like I said, are more invested. They're better audiences. And I anticipate that they'll continue to grow. You know, the people that maybe stayed away because it was $5 when it used to be free are now like, well, it's $5, whatever. And they'll come back. They'll start coming back. And we'll probably get to a point where we're going to have to say, this show is sold out. Now, I don't anticipate that happening. A sold-out show right now would be 40,000 people, and that's a lot of people to buy a $5 ticket. Even $5, 40,000 is a lot. So I don't anticipate anything to sell out, but down the road it probably will. And then we'll have to look at again, what are we going to do? So we're either going to say these shows are going to sell out at 30,000 people and we're going to keep it there, or we're going to have to say, okay, now the ticket's $10. I hope we never get to the point where the tickets are anywhere close to what a normal concert would be. I still want this to be a community event. I still want it to be an accessible event. I still want it to be engaging as many people from this community as possible. You know, so when they look at it and go, I can't go see U2 for $125, but I can go see the National for $5. Yeah, absolutely, I'm going. And I think that I think the audiences are just remarkable. I think it's a great group of people. I think they're invested in the concert series. They're proud of it. I hope they are anyway. I know a lot of people are. And I think that in general, when we get to that point where we start bursting at the seams again, we'll reevaluate and say, what do we do? How much larger are we going to go again? And how big of names are we going to chase? You know, and where is it going to go from there?
To hear about the rest of this year's lineup and more information on the series itself, be sure to visit them online at twilightconcertseries.com. Thank you for listening to Soundwaves from the Underground, and for all things Slug Magazine, be sure to visit us online at slugmag.com. We're going to have Yelp's Jeffrey Stedman pop back into the studio in an upcoming episode to tell us all about the favorite ice cream treats and restaurants around Utah. We'd like to hear what you think. Either send us an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We want to hear where you get your frosty treats in the summer, and when we do, we just might play it on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. The executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan and the technical design by Kate Colgan. Be sure to fire us up again next week when we talk to the infamous String Dusters, a fine string band. We talk to Yelp's Jeffrey Stedman, and we talk Rooftop Concert Series down Provo way. Thanks for listening.